Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Although these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air, as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you for your rambling. Thank you for the disclaimer that you've given to all of us. We appreciate that. This evening, we're going to return back to the order of things that we've been doing now for the last, one, two, three, four, five, 6 weeks, where I brought you from, I was born a first-class citizen. The second week, we talked about the big picture, that is the 30,000-foot view. The third week, we talked about how the Congress converts state citizens into federal citizens. The fourth week, we talked about the origin of the federal citizen. And the fifth week, we talked about how state citizens are converted into federal citizens. And then the week before last, the sixth week, we talked about the common law versus commercial law. Tonight, the seventh week of running, remember last week we did an introductory call for GW, who now is doing the Monday night calls live. Anyone that's on this call should now include with absolute certainty the king element to your success in any litigation that you're going to be going through, at least the greatest leverage that you could ever possibly have, and that is to learn how to correct your status. Tonight, we're going to talk about more federal glue, more things that adhere you into this relationship with the federal government, wherein you, my friend, are a slave. You're owned by them. We covered those court cases before. You may also find it disturbing to know how an administrative procedure can remove your children from you. In 1921, Congress passed the Shepard-Towner Act, a maternity act, that created the United States Birth Registration Area. You can reference Public Law 97 on the 67th Congress, Session 1, Chapter 135, and the year was 1921. That act allows you to register your children when they are born. If you do so, you will get a copy of a birth certificate. By registering your children, which is voluntary, they become federal children. And this does several things. Your children become subjects of the Congress. They lose their state citizenship. A copy of the birth certificate is then sent to the Department of Vital Statistics in the state in which they were born. The original birth certificate is then sent to the Department of Commerce in the District of Columbia, and it then gets forwarded to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, in Europe. And your child's future labor and your child's future properties are put up as collateral for the public debt. Once a child is registered, a constructive trust is formed. The parents usually become the trustee, the person managing the assets of the trust. The child becomes the asset of the trust, and the state becomes the principal beneficiary of the trust. Reference the Uniform Trustees Power Act. If the beneficiary does not believe the trustee is managing the assets of the trust optimally, the beneficiary can go through an administrative procedure to change trustees. And this is the way the bureaucrats can take children away from their parents if the bureaucrat does not like the way the child is cared for. Well, you may say there's nothing wrong with this. If a parent is neglecting a child, then the state really, you know, should come in and remove the parents from the child, or the child from the parents. Under common law, a child can still be removed from the parent, but it takes 12 jurors from the county to do so. Theoretically, a bureaucrat could remove your children from you if you just disagree with some unrelated administrative procedure, such maybe homeschooling your child. This is another way the government can intimidate citizens who question its authority. And with all this in mind, the statement that the president says every few months is, quote, "Our children are our most valuable asset," end quote. Well, it takes on a different meaning when you look at it through this light. Your children are their assets. Part of the process of restoring my state citizenship is by correcting my status with the federal government through the State Department of the United States, which is what you'll learn about on the Monday night calls that we do now. If you do not correct your status, then you are a 14th Amendment citizen, deemed a 14th Amendment citizen, continue to be a 14th Amendment citizen, and your labor and all your assets are put up as the collateral for the public debt. When the government communicates with corporations, it spells the name of the corporation in all upper capital letters, uppercase letters. If the government refers to you with your name in all capital letters, it actually means to treat you like a corporation. A corporation is created by the government. Corporations have no rights. The government gives its privileges, and the corporation must follow the rules of its creator. Now, I'm not a corporation. Are you a corporation? A state citizen or an American national should challenge the government's assertion that he or she is a corporation. Again, doing so by correcting your status. This applies to both postal matters and court documents. We gave the federal government the right to regulate commerce. We did. Since the government has started usurping our sovereignty, our language has been subtly modified to include commercial terms. Most people do not realize or care that they are using commercial terms, but the courts do. If you describe your actions in commercial terms in a court, the judge will take silent notice of your status as being regulatable by the federal government. In the example I'm about to share with you, the commercial terms are going to be said loudly. Instead of a birthing room, you're now born in a delivery room. Instead of traveling in your car, you are driving or operating a motor vehicle in traffic. You don't have a guest in your car. You have passengers. Instead of a nativity, you have a date of birth. You're not a worker. You're an employee. And you don't own a house, but you own real estate. These are just some of the additional federal glues that bring things together. Next week, as a preface to bringing PJ aboard, we will talk about lost rights. Until then, however, we need to have PJ here, and he's not. My goodness. Can you excuse me for just 1 second? I'm going to see if I can't just ring him in here real quickly. One moment. Here we go. There's his phone number. Press the button. Okay, We got him. He's calling in. In the meantime, let me just take this opportunity to remind everyone on this call that the same phone number and the same PIN number and the same time that you've come here to listen to PJ present jurisdiction and how it plays into any legal matters that you may have, as well, you need to be on the Monday call to give PJ and the others on the team the single tool that is the most incredible leverage. It's a fulcrum with a capital F, and that's what you want. Not only does this give you the opportunity in your instant matter that you're dealing with, but for those of you that have a history where you want to void that those things from the public record, this is your opportunity to, because everything that's been done in your lifetime has been done with you being considered a federal citizen. And by challenging jurisdiction, and remember, jurisdiction can be challenged at any time. 50 years later, jurisdiction can be challenged. It's going to be to your advantage. PJ, I laid a groundwork for the difference, again, between federal citizens and state citizens or American nationals. What would you have to share with us this evening, sir?
Oh, I guess I could add that that is definitely a element of the crime in many of the attacks that they bring against you. The jurisdiction of your prosecution is based on either a contractual relationship to be a U.S. person, which if that does exist, you are not afforded the Bill of Rights, therefore you're subject to the military court of the United States, which all the courts of the United States are military, statutorily. And if they do not have that evidence, then you are afforded the Bill of Rights, which gives you the right to a common law jury, and they have very little control of keeping all the facts and all the law available to be brought before the jury. So essentially, my experience in federal court, for example, is that they don't want the jury to know a great deal of the evidence. We have a case in Nebraska right now, an IRS case, or I have a case, I should say, a client. He filed 10 years of 6203s, but he did it along with his filing of the 1040 tax forms. He didn't understand. I guess he did understand, but he was fearful not to file a 1040 tax form. So he sent it in together. He said, if I don't have a requirement to file a 1040 tax form or pay any taxes over to the United States, please notify me. If not, go ahead and process the 1040 tax form and receive and accept the payment. And they just ignored the request for the assessment, which I don't think they can actually do. What we're discovering is that the United States did not want anything in the record as to a 6203 assessment, or at least before the jury. He did get it into the record, but he didn't get it before the jury. And they did not want me to testify. He brought me in to testify to the fact that I have hundreds of clients that send 6203s in to the government to see if they're taxable. I don't know how many hundreds. I've been doing it for 20 years. This is the first time the IRS has ever decided to prosecute one of them, and I think it was because he was sending in the 1040s with it. All the other people never sent the 1040s in, and they just continually waited for the IRS to assess them, which they never did, and never did bother, and as far as I can tell, any of them were ever bothered. But the situation in Nebraska, for example, is that And we did challenge personal jurisdiction. You know, what did he say, do or sign to be subject to that U.S. court? And they have to produce that evidence. They never did produce the evidence. So we're going back into court to get them to produce that. Now, the only evidence they're producing is that he did submit a filing into the United States system. But that filing had a contingency on it. If he's required to file, receive it as a filing. What's interesting is what we've discovered is that if he's not required to file, they cannot receive it as a filing. He's not eligible. He's not qualified. The documents and the payments he sent in could not ever rise to an actual law filing, and the payment could never be deemed as a duty to pay. It could only rise to the level of a donation. And they just were terrified of letting me into the testify to that. And what they did is when he tried to call me as a witness, the prosecutor stood up and claimed that he was trying to call me as an expert witness. When he wasn't trying to call me as an expert witness. He was only trying to call me to testify to what he's done for the last 10 years and what exactly did he file for the last 10 years, because he sent us copies of what he filed, because we offer to keep a record of what they file in case his house would burn down or something. He'd like to have an off-site place of all the filings. But the government would not allow me to be a witness. Now, this is what's interesting in that case, is that was a good faith defense. He had a good faith defense because he submitted documents as to filing. It's very interesting that the government did not want that in front of the jury at all. So what Michael Edwards is talking about here is a means to quite often prevent you from getting into such a corrupt court situation. If you're being prosecuted under common law, the jury gets to hear all the evidence that you're willing to present. Now, they get to decide if it's germane to the case or not. If you go in and try to, you know, read the entire Bible to them, they're probably going to get quite angry and find you guilty of something. But if you want to go in and quote part of the Bible, one of my clients just this week, he had an individual testify against him, and that's supposedly the only witness they have, and he quoted the Bible to them, two or more witnesses. There's a reason why the Bible says two or more witnesses, because it prevents an individual from framing you. And generally, biblically, an individual can't bring charges against you without other evidence. So this is very interesting. I think this thing that Michael Edwards is entertaining here is going to be extremely broad. One of the things I learned in dealing with the state is that as soon as they found out that you had a potential to bring the issue, to force the issue to go before a common law proceeding, they backed out. There's an individual from California, I can't remember his name right now, I had it on my memory a moment ago, Richard McDonald, he was being prosecuted by the state, and he required a common law proceeding, and they immediately dismissed the case, because that's the last thing they want in a courtroom is an opportunity for somebody to bring all the evidence before the jury and actually have a record that can go public after that. So I'm sorry I was late. My phone's alarm system didn't go off. I always have it go off 5 minutes before 10 minutes before I'm supposed to be on, 5 minutes before I'm supposed to be on, and again, when I'm supposed to be on. So it gives me three opportunities to get to hear the alarm. So I'd never, this doesn't happen. But it, for some reason, it didn't happen. So I must have pushed a button and turned the alarm system off. Michael, is that something we can elaborate on, what I just presented, as far as what you're looking for?
I had to unmute.
Testing.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that this correcting your status that you're referring to, it's like showing up, you know, with a 50 caliber Barrett, and everybody else is you know, handling swords and knives. It's absolutely fatal. Go ahead.
It's truly it's a jurisdictional challenge. These U.S. courts, they think they have a monopoly on all these events that occur, and they think they can drag it in front of an administrative court and railroad the people into their prison systems. And guess what? The Constitution doesn't allow it. The Constitution allows them to have courts and laws to deal with their lands, but it doesn't allow them to have courts and laws to deal with the people's lands jurisdiction. And when Michael and I go abroad and talk to police officers and the general public about this, they just sit down and scratch their head like,
no clue.
Well, that makes sense, no but clue. I've never heard this before. Is that your experience, Michael?
Yeah, they look at you like, the police have been already trained. Their knee-jerk response is, oh, you're one of those sovereign citizens. You know, that's what they've been taught to say, to ask.
That's exactly the words they'll use at the road stops. Oh,
exactly.
Are you a sovereign citizen?
Oh, that's their training.
Yep.
And then I'll say, you know, if if you'd ask questions or looked at the definitions of the word sovereign and looked at the definition of the word citizen, you cannot use them in a hyphenated sense. They're totally opposite each other. A sovereign stands alone above all things. A citizen is a subject.
Yeah,
it's a sovereign.
It's an oxymoron. Anyway. You can't put them together. They also, several times I've been stopped and I start explaining the law to them a little bit, and they'll ask if I'm one of the Freeman's groups too. I think that's a group out of, Montana, I think. So they've been trained. It's so weird. I'd be in different parts of the country and they'd say the same thing. I go, my gosh, you guys only have one book in the nation to quote these things. It was a little bit bizarre. But I remember Louis Ewing. He was pulled over once, and this guy was just a legal mind. You know, he'd just keep digging and digging until he found the truth in the law. And he would eventually traumatize the Washington area jurisdiction, the state of Washington. And when he got pulled over, on his screen it would come up, do not detain, do not arrest, and he personally seen it on his screen. He's been traveling to, I think it was a year ago, maybe 2 years ago at the most, but he was traveling to go speak, and he had to cross three states, and he said that as soon as he left his home state of Washington, he noticed I can't remember if it was one or two cars followed him, and they followed him all the way to the meeting place. And when he got to the meeting place, those two cars or one car took pictures of all the license plates in the parking lot, which is no big deal. I don't care if they have my plate number. They should have your plate number. If you're doing anything that amounts to anything, you're going to be in their system. If you're being running so scared that you're not in their system, you're just not doing anything. So, you know, I just can't help you. If you stick your head up, you might get shot in the head. But if nobody sticks their head up, you're going to lose the war for sure. And that's really bad. Yeah. Michael, what do you got next?
To add to what you're talking about, It may be 3 months. It may be 6 months. I hope it's no more than 6 months. If we have a few hundred people by, you know, 3 months from now, maybe 6 months from now, who have gone through the process of correcting their status with the State Department of the United States, that's who it's that does the status repair, then my next presentment to PJ and to others in what I refer to as the team is to organize a grand jury, a petit jury, and begin holding trials. We can hold the trials on the internet. We don't have to be in a building physically together. We can do it on the internet and do this under Article 7 of our Constitution, of the federal Constitution. Now, I'm quick to remind everybody, the federal Constitution was created by the states, the several states, okay? It's we the people, through our individual state constitutions, that directs our states to have created the federal government, which is why I refer to the federal government as our government. That's an important distinction. So once we have this Article 7, Amendment 7 assembly put together, whether a case has been filed or it needs to be reviewed, then you can have a jury of your peers adjudicate the matter. And then with permission, you have to ask permission, you can then enter a foreign judgment into their court system. And with that, they can't charge you because that would be double jeopardy. And that is the law. So they can't come after you because you are not a federal citizen. You're a citizen within the freely associated compact states, or otherwise known as an American national. And there's nothing they can do with you. And they have to honor the judgment because it is under the federal law that we, the people, put in place to make that happen, Amendment 7. So that's going to be the next evolution. While in the meantime, we have right now about a half a dozen people that have come into the program. The outcome of this is that their matters will be taken care of, we hope, now in much shorter order. But in addition to that, there are those others that are coming into it that are already into this program of the six that have a historical criminal record. And we're going to open those criminal records right open and demand that, once their status is changed, they're going to demand the jurisdictional challenge afforded them. So all that's very, very interesting, and that's where the future is that we're looking to unfold. PJ, unless you've got anything else to comment, I'd like to suggest that we open it up for questions and answers.
Let me make a quick comment here. When you go into a U.S. court, and I've been in there hundreds of times, hundreds, I don't know, 350 times, I think. But
bracelets and anklets when you walked in?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, quite often. They do that to, you're in there for a parking ticket, and they're going to put, they're going to put handcuffs on your feet and your hands and put you in an orange outfit that doesn't fit right. They just want to intimidate you as much as possible. But if you hold your own, and they realize that you're an intelligent person, it puts a lot of fear into them. And if you do have anybody come to the trial, make sure they dress well, like they are a individual that may be a reporter, a private, what do they call those private reporters? They write for a whole bunch of different articles, publications. Yeah, something like that. And you just walk in, and when the judge will usually send out somebody to try to find out who you are, because you got to You got a white shirt on, you got a tie, and you're sitting right in front, and you got a notebook, and you're taking notes like crazy. And that judge gets real curious of who in the world you are. And when they ask you who you are, you just tell them that you're like Michael said, a freelance reporter, I think is what they're called also. And just don't say anything else, because they don't know if you're writing for World News or Washington Post, you know. They just don't know. And both of those can reach a lot of people. But what I was going to say is that the main people that damage you is the officer that arrests you or writes you the citation, the court clerk, the prosecutor, sometimes it's the court reporter, and sometimes it's almost every time it's the judge. And in these common law settings, if you have absolute solid evidence that somebody violated your rights, now the definition of violating your rights is you can convince the majority of 12 people that they did wrong to you. That's the definition of violating your rights. If you can consistently convince the majority of a jury, you've got a case. So we have a case going on right now that several of them, matter of fact, where the court clerk was stopping us from filing documents. So we're filing criminal charges against them. Now, I believe we can, you know, if a court clerk damaged you or a judge damaged you, yeah, you can go into their system and ask them to have a proceeding to correct it, to put it under scrutiny and examine it. And you also have a right to bring it to the highest court in the land, or at least the second highest court in the land is the people. The highest court in the land is God. But the second highest court in the land is the people. And you can bring it into a Seventh Amendment proceeding under civil damages. We don't want the guy to be thrown in jail, really. We want his house. If he sits in jail and I don't get anything out of it, you know, what good is that? But if I get his house, then that's completely different. The main thing is we're going to put the fear in them so they don't do it to anybody else down the road. That's the most important thing you can do to people. But anyway, the pocketbook. You go after the pocketbook of these people and they get really nervous. We've had people come to us afterwards, court clerks and so forth, and court reporters that had to lie, had to alter the transcripts because the judge told them to, and they were afraid to lose their life or their at the minimum their job or their good relationships with the people at the courthouse. And generally when these people do mischief, they know that they're going to be brought right into in front of the same judges potentially that are doing the same mischief. So they're not scared. But if they think that there's any chance that you're going to bring them in front of a common law proceeding where 12 people cannot be interfered by anybody else, and you get to bring all the evidence to them, nobody's going to say, oh, you can't have that recorder, you can't have that camera, you can't have those secret microphones. Well, we're going to let the jury decide that. The United States doesn't let that happen quite often is because they'd have too many of their federal and state judges in jail if they allowed secret cameras and stuff to be put up. But the common law jury...
While you were talking. What would happen if this, say, a year from now or a year and a half from now grew to where there were, you know, several hundred people in each state that had corrected their status, where you had maybe three or four or five within a 1, 2, 3 county radius that could go to a courtroom, a particular court, in the gallery. They all have the same red blazer, white shirt, blue slacks, something, you know, hokey, but something clearly identifying them as being together.
A press pass around their neck.
Sure. And we could do that, too. We can become a reporting agency if we want to. It's no big deal. And then the judge says, you all are dressed kind of nice and nifty. You know, are you part of a group? And one of them already is prepared and stands up and says, yes, Your Honor, we are. All four of us here have corrected our status. We are not federal citizens. We are American nationals. We're citizens of the freely associated compact state, you know as Florida. And we're here to observe, gather evidence, to see if any crimes take place by any players, any actors in this courtroom today. What
yes,
effect would that
absolutely
have?
Absolutely. The
and then Your Honor will take that evidence, and then Your Honor will take that evidence back to a Seventh Amendment court of our peers, and will judge. Yeah, back to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, and they guess what? They have no authority to shut down any Seventh Amendment court. Zero.
No.
It is not their jurisdiction. What I was going to say is, we're using the word correct your status. It's not a question of you were once a U.S. person, now you're not a U.S. person. That very likely may not be the situation. Most of the situation is going to be their records have you as a U.S. citizen. They have a false record on you.
DJ?
Yep.
Yeah, that's why it's being
yep.
corrected.
So we're correcting the record because it's false. Yes.
Yeah.
That's good.
Exactly. All right.
Press star two on your keypad,
ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hands. Press star two. I'm sure you've got a lot of questions for PJ tonight. Press star two. And while you're thinking about raising your hand, I'm going to go over to Freedoms Radio and see if there's any questions over there that have already been raised. They have instructions on how to proceed if they want to, and you may already have something there. Let me refresh. Oh, nobody there asked a question. We have Michael in Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead.
How are we doing tonight?
Great, thank you.
Good.
What's your
question is you get your status taken care of and you're in court, and you start to ask them questions about their jurisdiction or authority, or how about their bond, because aren't they all required to carry a bond?
Yep, yep. Let's go back to PJ on that, because PJ's covered this on several of his earlier calls, particularly with regards to traffic. Before there is even the first appearance, PJ, you want to talk about some of the paperwork that's filed before there is the first appearance?
Yeah, you're challenging. See, they have to have evidence in their record to have a compelling purpose for you, as a matter of law, for you to appear in their courtroom. They have to have evidence on the record to complete the sufficiency of the court. They have to have evidence on the record that you're a person subject to their court, that the activity is listed in their written law, and that activity is sworn to have occurred. In a land space, land is always a space, it's not a surface, it's a space, where that written law has force and effect of law. Okay, United States written law is limited land jurisdiction in almost all cases. So we challenge that to be on the record. And if it's not on the record, I had a situation where I didn't go to court four times, and they kept arresting me. And on the fourth time, the judge said, you know, we can't let you go, PJ, because you failed to appear in court four times. And I demanded that he took a judicial notice on the Fourth Amendment, and he tried to ignore me. I said it again. He ignored me, said it again. He ignored me. Then I finally said, take judicial notice of the Fourth Amendment now, as found in the Constitution for the United States of America, as written in 1791. And the judge put his head down, finally said he'll take judicial notice of it, like a little kid taking medicine, it reminded me of. And within 10 minutes, the case was dismissed. But he made a show in front of everybody as though they were hauling me off to jail. But they took me out in the hall, took my handcuffs off, and I walked away. So anyway, the jurisdictional challenge quite often is ignored, and you have to push it. You have to push it by not showing up in court, like I did. A friend that taught me that was a paralegal, and he worked in a law office with 70 lawyers, and they told him that is pretty much what you have to do to force them to prove up all three elements of jurisdiction. You just don't go in and have them arrest you. So we're going to go back and sue them for the false arrest. Now, those false arrests, two head prosecutors resigned from their job around that. And these guys were making, one guy was making $190,000 a year. I don't know what the other guy was making. The $190,000 a year was the head prosecutor, and he's been there 19 years. I guarantee you he didn't resign the day I subpoenaed him into court because it was coincidence. The sheriff actually came out and told me that he resigned because of me, and the sheriff was very curious, what in the world are you doing to causing these guys to resign? Basically, we're challenging jurisdiction, and that's what the status correction of your record is. Now, you got to be careful. If you don't have a evidence in a record of your status, and you go into their land and do an activity, you're going to be treated like a U.S. person, and status is not an issue. So you just learn how to stay out of their land jurisdictions, which is most of America, and it makes them much harder for them to prosecute you. But anyway, as far as the bonds go, I personally have never heard anybody successful with bonds, but it is part of it. They usually bug out of there for another reason. So we've never had them actually drop off the record because of no bond. So we don't really push that because there's a lot of other ones that you can push, and you can always push that at the end. So that's right. That's my experience with bonds. Now, go ahead.
Right. Well, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there is a woman who is not trained in the law. She has a child that is autistic, marginally autistic. He's able to go to public school, but he's like special ed type thing. And they required him to wear a mask. And when he put the mask on, he got claustrophobic and just would go off the deep end. And the school told the parent that she had to take him out of school. Well, she went to the school board. Before she went to the school board meeting that met the next time, she found the bond company of the school board superintendent. And she lodged a complaint against the school board superintendent's bond to the bond company. And it was like a $300,000 complaint. $300,000 complaint. When she brought it to the attention of the school board, immediately they dropped the mask mandate. And incidentally, you know the definition of a mandate, PK? A mandate is when two fellows go out on a date. It's a mandate.
Oh.
Anyway.
Okay, you don't have to worry about that with me then.
they dropped the mask mandate immediately. Meanwhile, the superintendent has been notified to have to pay this $300,000 bond. The school's attorneys will not defend her or intervene, literally leaving her out to dry. They threw her under the bus, the school superintendent. That's a powerful position. And there, and that happens. So
honestly, I've heard of situations like that. I have.
So my thinking is that the very, very first thing that I would want to do if I'm going before any court, I don't care if it's traffic court or small claims or whatever, I'm being brought in, I'm going to FOIA immediately the bond company for that judge. And unless that information is brought forth, we're not proceeding, period. File a lawsuit.
Not only does the judge have to be bonded, the department has to be bonded. So what that means is, I can't remember the actual issue, but this small town did something. I think they had this steep hill that went down to the small town, and these cops, every day they'd sit behind these haystacks or something like it and write tickets, because everybody would come over that hill and let up on the gas, and you're just not going to slow down and get below the 35 mile an hour speed limit or whatever it was. You're just not gonna. You'd have to ride the brakes pretty hard, and people just don't like to do that because there's nobody around, and give it time, the car will slow down pretty reasonably. So they were writing tickets to all kinds of people, but they found out, somebody investigated, and they found out they weren't writing any local tickets. The local boys were always let off. So they took it into court, and the federal court made them return all those tickets. And the bond company came in and took the bond insurance away from the community, and they had to close their library, their swimming pool. All kinds of things had to close down because they didn't have any bond anymore, and they couldn't get another company to cover them. So there's an example of where the bond or lack of a bond shut things down. So there's different ways to look at bonds. But it basically, a bond is there so that if a person does damage you, that that you have recourse financially to go after them. Whereas otherwise, the judges would say, oh, I got everything in a trust, and you can't come after me, or whatever. But anyway, so... Yeah.
So the bottom line is to all of this, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, the bottom line to all of this, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have the tool now, the leverage, the fulcrum, the crowbar, whatever you want to call it, that we can move things like we've never been able to move them before. You take someone like PJ with his courtroom experience and the team that he works in. Their courtroom experience, you're talking some of them have their juris doctorate, their doctors in law, in the law, they have that. They've gone to law school and they've graduated, summa cum laude or at the top of the class. Others are trained paralegals, bonded by a state that they're in. Others, states don't require paralegals to be bonded or licensed. And then you've got just others that are not formally trained, but I put them up against most any attorney that's out there. Michael, did that answer your question?
Pretty much. I think there's a federal law that unlawful detention is $10,200 a day, not against the judge himself, but against the county. They have to pay because they're covering the judge.
I heard was $3,500 an hour.
Well, that's even better.
Yeah, that's even better. All right, thank you, Michael. Anybody
thank
else,
you.
Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2 on your keypad. We don't want to make this an early call or too early. All right, next is somebody else from Las Vegas. You bring a friend with you, Michael? Go ahead. Caller ending in 6295, your first name only, please.
Yes, sir. It's Emily.
Hey, Miss Emily. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. How about yourself?
Very well, thank you. How did you hear about the call tonight? Your first time caller?
Actually, I'm a first-time caller. I just joined in to the podcast. My father is actually Michael, who you're just speaking with.
Okay.
And I'm actually located in Tampa, Florida.
You are?
Well, yes, sir.
You're about 4 hours from me.
In fact,
okay.
PJ was just in Tampa
this past week. He might still be there right now, for all I know.
Because I have some questions in regards to fixing my status. When I first came in, I heard as far as after the disclaimers about the six-week course that you all were doing, and that was the first one was I was born a first-class citizen for the first week. The second week was first-class view. I didn't catch what your third week was about.
Sure. Hold on a second. Let me go back to that page. PJ,
yes,
you got a lot of back noise there. I have to either mute you or you need to settle down, one of the two ways.
moving some stuff around here. I'll be much more careful.
Right. Sounds like pots and pans. All right, the first week was titled, I Was Born a First Class Citizen, meaning that you were born in one of the several states of the Union. Then the second week, we talked about the 30,000-foot view, just a global look at everything. The third week was talking about how the Congress converts a national citizen or a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states into a federal citizen. And just as an interjection, the reason that I do that whole sentence, freely associated compact state, is because that's the exact phrase that the Congress used when they translated Alaska as a territory into statehood. Okay, that's the phrase they use, so I want to use that phrase. Also, if you go to the United States Code, you'll learn that they actually have defined the term. PJ, I'm going to mute you, and then I'll unmute you in just a moment.
Okay.
For that. I have to.
Yeah.
Just to...
Thank you.
All right. Anyways, because the United States Code actually defines the term state and county and city, so that's a federal term referencing a division of territory, the territories of the United States under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. So I don't use the word state naked by itself. I always have that phrase there. Then the fourth week was the origin of the federal citizens, how they came into being, because the country did not start out with federal citizens. The fifth week was how state citizens are converted into federal citizens. The sixth week was just talking about how the common law is different from commercial law. And then tonight we talked about the more federal glues that put things together. Next week we're going to talk about rights that have been lost correcting your status. After that will be some unanswered questions that people would like to ask if they knew to ask the questions. And then lastly, a conclusion to all of this. And then I'm going to repeat this every week. That's going to be from my intro from now on. And so that's where we're at with that. And if you like this, where are they posted? Oh, I forgot. I've been under ransomware attack now for going on almost 6 months, and my archives have been shut down until I can afford to bring in a programmer to put up the necessary walls or whatever to stop that. Any questions, Emily?
Curious in regards to what was it, the 14th Amendment citizen, or when you're going into, it's more so in regards to jurisdiction, because I've had issues with the City of Tampa Police Department, but also one of the judges that presides in the 13th Judicial Sector of Hillsborough County Court, like trying to differentiate the jurisdiction. And when I went against him, more so when I questioned his jurisdiction in the courtroom is when he held me in contempt for 90 days.
Sure. And let me interject right there, if I may.
Yeah.
How dare you? How dare you? Property
Correct.
Of the federal government sit there and make a judge uncomfortable. You should have spent 180 days in the pen. How
yeah.
dare you? The umbrage. You upstart you?
Right.
When you correct
right.
your status, when you correct your status, you are the boss going in there.
So then the next question
sure.
will be how, I mean, because I heard you say something as far as filing, I believe it was with the state or hold on, I was writing it down. Give me one moment.
It's the State Department of the United States that is correcting your status.
Right. So if I go to the State Department, what do I file or how do I go about doing it? Because I know these are more like terms that they've blocked or they don't want to accept or believe because they go by in which I've noticed a lot of people, especially younger people and generations of my age, do not accept, I would say, law. They go off of hearsay or what the last person told them what to do
right,
versus
right.
actually a book. So that's a lot of, I would say, blockades that I've been running into.
Right. Well, here's the thing. When you go through
yes,
the process,
sir.
First off, we're not going to talk on the call openly about the
right.
process because if it's done wrong, then perhaps a precedent would be set, and we're not going to allow that to happen. So
right.
we're going to firmly control and spoon feed you along the way. There
okay.
will be segments
okay.
of it that. In other words, we're making it so that nobody can duplicate it on their own. Why? Not because we're trying to be greedy and keep it all to ourselves, but there's two people. There's one kind of person that we don't want to involve with this, and that is somebody who is of a criminal mind because they
Correct.
Can use this to create, you know, havoc on their neighbor and not have to pay the penalty. And the second
right,
thing
right.
is that you've got somebody they know enough about the law to hurt themselves, and they go in
yeah.
half-cocked. In other words, they even got the card from the State Department, but now they don't know how its application is used in court. We're here offering a turnkey support for everything that you're doing once you come into the program. So
that
should be made clear.
About is the one that your remedy is in thelaw.com. Is that correct?
The hierarchy is that AmericansRestoringAmerica.com is the umbrella
okay.
website for everything. And your
okay.
remedy is in the law is underneath that. Then underneath your remedy is in the law is American by is Americans by birth. American by birth is correct my status.com, the ultimate and
okay.
asset protection.com. Those are all subs to your remedies in the law.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, what was the first one, your umbrella one? Because I didn't catch it.
Americans Restoring America.
Americans Restoring America. Thank you.
Yeah. I also bought the domain name. I love it. It's AmericansWithPitchforks.com. It'll redirect you to Americans Restoring America.
Okay. love it.
Yeah. So
I appreciate it. I mean, my dad introduced me into the program, and I just want to thank you, gentlemen, one, for the knowledge, but two, for at least like with my father, enlightening me into, I guess, the ways of the land and the ways of man, basically.
Right. Yeah, your dad is very, very knowledgeable. I've had conversations with him in the past.
Yes, sir.
So just listen to your dad. He knows what's going on. And he's willing
yes,
to
sir.
Change. He's willing to redirect himself as new evidence comes forth. Which is great.
Correct.
You have a lot of people that are just stuck in their ways, and it's their way or the highway. All right, thank you so
right.
much. Next is Harold. Go ahead. Next is Harold.
Hi, Michael.
Go ahead, Harold.
PJ.
Yes, sir.
I got a Monday night question. Can I ask it?
Sure.
Oh, okay. If both my wife and I do the correcting our status, does that end the situation we're involved with the IRS at the present time?
It will throw the biggest monkey wrench in the middle of it that they've ever seen. You see, it's not just you correcting your status. And this is what I'm afraid of, is that people get a hold of this, they correct their status, and then what do I do with it? For us watching you do it on your own, it's kind of like watching an infant, you know, a toddler playing with a loaded pistol in front of you, and you can't stop them from doing anything. It can be very harmful to you if you don't. There has to be a proper challenge, is what I'm saying. And that's where people like PJ come in and the team come in to see that a proper challenge is done. We're not offering this as a standalone thing. We're offering this to be used in conjunction with the other work that needs to be done. This is going to be step one. In fact, unequivocally, no one will be getting any, in the future, will be getting any assistance, regardless of their issues, that have to do with the team. I'm not talking about Bernie and his social control and trust. Hold on, let me just kill this noise in the background. I'm not talking about Bernie and his trusts. Those are standalone and doesn't require this. This is the other half of the coin to what Bernie does. And we're not going to be taking on any new students in assisting them and educating them on how to defend themselves, whether it's Internal Revenue Service or maybe a cop planted, you know, a half a pound of cocaine in the trunk of your car when he asked to check your trunk, you know, whatever. Doesn't matter. You'll have to first correct your status.
Well, that's pretty much handles the situation then, because they got to lean against the house that we're trying to sell. Yeah, it's in a trust, and they called it a alter ego or whatever.
Alter ego.
Yeah. So
is it Bernie's trust?
What's that?
Is it Bernie's trust? The court trust.
It's not Bernie. No, it's not Bernie's trust. No, it's a grantor trust.
Are you the trustee?
No.
Somebody else is the trustee?
What's that?
Someone else is the trustee, a non-family member?
No, they're both family members.
See, that's the mistake. You've got to have somebody that's not a family member to be the trustee.
Yeah.
I mean, you
could turn around. Let me put to you this way, and this is really harsh terms. Please do not be offended when I say this.
When somebody is coming after a homeowner for a foreclosure, or to seize the property for judgment or whatever it is. That could be whether it's property tax or an IRS lien or just a money judgment from a credit card case, whatever it is. If that property is in a trust, a proper trust, and the trustee, now I'm talking civil trust, not Bernie's ecclesiastical trust, but just a regular civil trust, You've already lost your property. It hasn't happened yet. It's like people on death row, or they refer to them as dead man walking. When you're in your home and you're under foreclosure, you're under the various things that I just talked about, you've already lost your home. You're just still in it right now and having to go through the motions that may take 6 months or 3 years or whatever, but you've lost your home. So at that point, if you understand that, then you have another person like PJ or another member of the team become the trustee. Now there's no way.
Even of the grantor trust?
It's a grantor trust. You granted the trust into existence, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
You named a trustee.
Right.
So ask that trustee. After you name a successor trustee, which might be PJ or one of the members of the team, or somebody else that's knowledgeable in the law and well-disposed to using it, then ask that present trustee to stand away, to retire, and let the successor trustee come in. So PJ comes in, he enters into the record, makes an appearance in the record is what it's called, and now they have to deal with PJ. They don't have a choice. You may owe the debt, but he's in control of the res, the property. And at that point forward, now you can mix things up. PJ can do his thing. PJ can have some fun. The team can have some fun. Anyways, that's the thing to do, Harold, if I were similarly situated.
Well, yeah, the only issue is that we've got somebody that's going to be buying the house, and they want it right now, so we'll just have to pay the IRS off of our proceeds and move on.
I pray dearly that you do not do that. If the moment the event takes place, Harold, you contact me, and I can turn this team into the matter, and you can do something called offering to pay upon proof of claim. Hold on a second. Hold on a second, please. All right, back to you. Anyways,
okay.
The thing is that if you were in trouble in any way, shape, or form, and you still had a balance due on your mortgage, I'm asking everyone, after the event takes place, whether that event is something called the Mike G agreement or it's foreign currency that you may have purchased hoping that someday it would be worth more than what it's worth today, whatever it is, please do not pay off your bills immediately, but rather set that money aside so that a proper challenge can be made where it's called proof of claim or quiet title. So that's the option that you'd give them. And upon proof of claim,
What kind of time period are you talking about?
Well, the lawsuit's filed immediately. Stops everything. When a lawsuit is filed, the clock stops, and a new time sequence begins.
Okay, but the point is, and now it also stops the sale of our house to the person that really wants to buy it.
You don't want to sell your house, do you?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, that's our whole. We're in the process for the last 3 years trying to do it that way.
Oh, I see what you're doing. Now, you're selling your house to satisfy the debt. When you satisfy the debt, make certain that you write on the check, paid under threat, duress, and coercion.
Okay.
I would do that. I would write threat, duress, and coercion because
that's going to happen at closing, and whoever collects the money from the buyer I apparently puts a check in the mail to the IRS.
I understand, but that check is from you or the closing company?
What's that?
Is the check from the closing company or will the check come from you?
It'll come from the closing company.
Okay. Then make certain that, well, you can't make them do anything. Give us a call tomorrow or afternoon sometime, and let's put you in touch with the team and just no charge. Let them just talk to you real quickly about it. It won't take but a moment.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
Okay. My pleasure, Harold, as always. PJ, I've just unmuted you. Have you got anything else you want to talk about before we go home?
Yeah, I think the reason I'm making all that noise, I got a sweatshirt on scratching against the mic. And the reason I was late, I didn't readjust my time for Eastern Standard Time to Central Time. But anyway, as far as correcting their record as to status, like I said, it doesn't eliminate all the problems. you can certainly have a nexus with the United States that brings you into their jurisdiction. So you always got to be careful of that. Now, this individual that has they claim a tax obligation, he must contact us and let us examine the situation, because he may be in a situation to walk away with several million dollars potentially here. It's not that difficult to put the burden of proof on the IRS to produce the evidence for their claim. They've damaged you already, so you can get a lot of money for their damages. Now, as far as correcting their records, that can lead into being able to open a bank account without a passport. Without a passport, without a Social Security number. It leads into getting a passport without a Social Security number. If you have a passport without a Social Security number, the government cannot block your passport. If you have a passport with a Social Security number, they can block it for a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah.
If you have a divorce situation, if you have your status record corrected, it shows that you do not have a state marriage license. Even if you went down and purchased one, therefore the assets or the marriage has to be handled in common law, which makes it a lot harder for them to steal from one party and give it to the other, and the attorneys get most of it in the middle. So there's all kinds of things that come out of understanding your right as a man. So it's not just in the court systems at all. It's in the banking. It's in property taxes. It's in potentially in sales taxes, automobile taxes, insurance. All kinds of things come into play. It opens a whole new world to you.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, PJ. Tomorrow, Mike.
All righty. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. I hope you enjoyed the show, the call. And that's what it is with the show. It's very important that you understand that this is all about entertainment, because I would never want anyone to drop their badge over my nose and say, "You were practicing law without a license, weren't you?" And I'm going to say, "Nah, just talking about education, what we might do when we're similarly situated, nothing else." Thank you again. See you hopefully Saturday with Judge Bernie, learning how to own nothing and control everything, become judgment proof. And then again next Monday, we'll be coming back with GW and about correcting your status. And then here we are back again with PJ Tuesday. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.